And you broke your celibacy contract to sleep with Ingrid?
She's my girlfriend, and she wanted to have sex.
And you fantasized about someone else?
Only so I could please Ingrid.
All I'm hearing are excuses for going only halfway. No wonder you're still cheating.
Rick and I are in his Range Rover, discussing my idiotic text. We park in the gravel driveway of a house available for rent. It looks like the kind of giant hippie treehouse that Father Yod and his wives would have lived in. I can explain.
I'm all ears.
Spoken with a wry smile, as if he's preparing to be deeply amused by whatever I say next. There were two schools of thought in rehab. One was taught by a very compassionate woman named Lorraine. From her, we learned that we weren't there for our partners, but ourselves. And the goal is to separate from our parents and our wounds so we can live our authentic lives.
And the other?
The other school of thought was more puritanical. It was taught by a very strict woman named Joan. And she believes that masturbation, pornography, seduction, fantasy, and casual sex are all unhealthy. And that basically anything other than lifelong monogamy is a symptom of sexual addiction and intimacy avoidance.
Why can't they both be right?
You've got to be kidding me. Then nearly every male in the country should be in rehab.
Who goes to rehab and just picks and chooses what they like? I think you have a false belief about how men are that you're using as a way of not feeling emasculated in the world. You were unhappy before in your old ways when you were single, and you're unhappy now in a relationship. You can go on this way for 5 or 10 years, and all you'll do is waste a ton of time sitting on the fence.
So what should I do? I'm so confused. I see the look of pity in Rick's eyes, like I'm some sort of lesser life form, a two-dimensional creature trying to understand the concept of three dimensions.
Here's what I suggest. Go into sex addiction recovery all the way. Starting today, everything an expert tells you, just do it without challenging it. Even if all you find are therapists like Joan who you don't agree with, hand over control anyway. If they tell you no sex for 90 days, then don't have sex for 90 days. If they tell you no masturbation or porn, then cut those things out.
I know I need to do something drastic, but you want me to just go along with even the most extreme things these people say without thinking about whether they make any logical sense or are true to myself?
Yes, exactly. How do you think I lost 135 pounds? I tried to lose weight for years, but wasn't able to do it until I finally gave up control to a nutritionist and a trainer. I didn't think about whether anything they said was true. I didn't even believe it would work, but I just submitted to the process and did it without judgment.
I think back to the moment of clarity I had in the chair with Lorraine. What would that opened-up version of myself advise me to do? He would say to just let go and love Ingrid. Okay, I'll try it.
Don't try. Do it. Really get into recovery and feel it for at least 90 days. And if at the end of that time you're still not happy, then do what you feel is right. Find an open relationship. Go crazy. Have all the sex with all the people you want and see how that feels. The goal is not monogamy or non-monogamy. It's for you to be living a life that brings you happiness.
That sounds like a great way to get off the fence before I fuck up my relationship again.
It may be your last chance. If you can't stick with it, maybe God will find a way for you to stick with it.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means that if you can't control your lust, the universe will take care of it for you.
He says this ominously, as if lightning is going to strike my prick, or it's going to get stuck in a blender if I don't keep it zipped up. Chapter 7. And so I'm back. Facing the firing squad. This time, the bullets are being loaded by Sheila Cartwright, Charles's therapist, supposedly the best in L.A. for sex addiction. She's an older woman with dreadlocks and beads in her hair like a teenage hippie, but she's sitting in a large armchair with a blanket over her legs like an old lady. In the spirit of Joan and Lorraine before her, she's another single woman surrounded by male sex addicts. Adam is also here. So is Calvin. Evidently, they were smart enough to stay in touch with Charles and join his private therapy group immediately on re-entry. There are also 5 cheaters I don't know, 3 of whom have been in the group for over 10 years. It's too bad there's no such thing as a woman who will let you do what you want and still love you, Calvin says, nudging me in the ribs as we sit in adjacent mismatched chairs in the therapy room. It feels good to be with my dysfunctional buddies again, except this time I need to be more like Charles and go along with the entire program. The meeting begins with each addict checking in and letting Sheila know how his week went. Instead of lecturing us like Joan, she feels for us in what seems like a tactic to get us more in touch with our own feelings. As Calvin tells us that he's thinking of returning to Brazil to be with his hooker when she gives birth to their son, she exhales slowly and melodramatically and looks at him with big, soft eyes, as if trying to absorb the pain and the hurt that he's not even aware he has. I was alone with my wife last night, Adam says during his check-in, so I asked her if she wanted to fool around. She got really mad and told me it was inappropriate and not intimate and not the way she likes to be propositioned, so it turned into a whole blow-up. After Sheila emotes for Adam and advises him to start with hand-holding, it's my turn to check in. I tell the group about the woman on the plane, the temptations of my inbox, the text to Belle, and renewing my commitment to recovery. Sheila's response is a hiss of escaping air and a sad puppy dog expression. She looks like she's trying to send me love. And for some reason, it makes me uncomfortable. I'm not sure if that's because she seems insincere or if, although I'm used to sex with no strings attached, I'm unaccustomed to emotion with no strings attached. When I smile awkwardly at her, Sheila finally speaks, ever so slowly. What you're doing is sexual hoarding. And when there's a problem in your relationship, you feel shame, like something is wrong with you. And there's an immediate reaction to that called defensive grandiosity. And that's when you start checking your hoard of messages. She shifts in her chair and the blanket slides off her lap. And that's fueled by anger, because it drives Ingrid away and makes you feel like you have power. Sheila looks through a copy of the file from rehab, listing all my ailments, real and imagined. She stands up slowly, placing her leg blanket back on the chair, then removes a book from a shelf and hands it to me. The title is Silently Seduced. Read this, she recommends. It's you. Charles leans forward in his chair and tells me, next time you see a woman like that one on the plane, use the 3-second rule. I'm stunned. The 3-second rule was something I learned during my time with the pickup artists. It means that when you see a woman you're attracted to, you have 3 seconds to approach her. Otherwise, either she'll notice you staring or you'll get too nervous to talk to her. You mean I should start a conversation with her? I ask Charles. No, he says, horrified. The 3-second rule means that as soon as you see someone and start objectifying them or fantasizing about them, you have a maximum of 3 seconds to focus on something else before the thought starts to get too strong and lead you into the addiction cycle. Remember, he wags a finger, bright red apple, wrong orchard. As I walk back to my car after the meeting, I flip through the book Sheila gave me and read a passage. The author, Dr. Kenneth Adams, writes, "Covert incest occurs when a child becomes the object of a parent's affection, love, passion, and preoccupation. The parent, motivated by loneliness and emptiness created by a chronically troubled marriage or relationship, makes the child a surrogate partner. To the child, the parent's love feels more confining than freeing, more demanding than giving, and more intrusive than nurturing." Suddenly, a lost memory comes back to me. It arrives first as a scent of sweet petroleum, then a vision of white cream. When most of my classmates were going to bed at 10 or 11 at night, my bedtime was 7:30. However, my mom would let me stay up and watch TV until 8 if I massaged her hands or feet. I'd pump moisturizer into my palms, then caress it into her olive-veined skin. When I finished, she'd tell me, "You're so much better than your father at this." At the time, I took it as a compliment, but now, a shudder of disgust runs through me. As a result of this confusing dynamic, Adams continues, when the child grows up, relationships often begin with immediate and total commitment, but this is soon followed by uncertainty and ambivalence. And often, having an affair is a way to be relieved of the struggle with commitment. When I shut the book, I see Charles standing next to me. I have no idea how long he's been there. I thank him for getting me into the group. In response, he opens a satchel he's carrying and pulls out a copy of the game. "Alfred Nobel," he says. I wait for the rest of the sentence, but evidently that's it. "What about him? Know him?" "Not personally." "Alfred Nobel, the same guy who invented dynamite, went on to create the Nobel Peace Prize." He looks at me, trying to make sure his point landed. And slowly what he's trying to say dawns on me. That a book about learning how to meet women is destructive. And a book about learning how to stop meeting them would be good for the world. And ironic. "I understand," I tell him. He tucks the book away and hands me a brochure for Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. The first sentence reads, "We in SLAA believe that sex and love addiction is a progressive illness which cannot be cured, but which, like many illnesses, can be arrested." "Let me ask you something," Charles says sharply, watching me. "Have you finally recognized that you have a disease?" I tell him, honestly, I can recognize it as a disease in a metaphorical sense. "No, it's a real disease, because it's not a choice. It may start off as a choice, but if you do anything to cope with stress or pain, the structure of the brain changes, and the behavior can go from an impulse to an addiction." "If that qualifies as a disease," I respond, recalling my pledge to Rick, "then I guess I have it." Charles seems unconvinced. "Let me do you a favor and prove to you that this is a disease. I'm going to set you up with a friend of mine, Dr. Daniel Amen. He's a brain expert specializing in addiction. He'll scan your brain for free and show you exactly where the disease is in your head and how to treat it." And I think, this is crazy. But I say, thank you. Chapter 8. Dr. Daniel Amen is a small, balding man, the son of a Lebanese grocery mogul, who has become, according to the Washington Post, the most popular psychiatrist in America. In the waiting room outside his office, a PBS TV program featuring the good doctor plays on infinite loop. I try to tune out his well-scripted patter about using brain scans for behavior assessment and modification while I work up the courage to go through the messages I've been ignoring on my phone. I scroll down the list and start politely responding to each tempting text, making sure to mention my girlfriend. Belle, the Australian I didn't unwrap for her birthday, says she's going to be stuck in Los Angeles on an overnight layover and wants to know if I'll be in town. I tell her, "Don't know yet, but I have a girlfriend, so can see you only as a friend." Anne, my online temptation from France, has sent another nude photo, this one of her pole dancing, her body curving in the air like tinder feeding the fire of my fantasy life. I write back, "Have enjoyed corresponding with you. Wish I'd met you in person, but in a relationship now." Each reply is painful, like hammering a nail into my scrotum. But I do it because I believe, because I'm behaving, because I want to become. I'm interrupted by a thin, sultry receptionist who calls me in to meet with Amen. His office staff seems to consist solely of attractive women in their 20s and 30s. I start to wonder if he has some undiagnosed sexual compulsiveness himself. When I enter Amen's office, he's sitting in a high-backed swivel chair, swallowed in oversized clothing, as if his body doesn't matter, only his brain. The walls are decorated with pictures of penguins, which have something to do with a children's book he wrote on positive reinforcement. In his hands, he's holding a sheaf of papers with green splotches on them that look like Hercules' snot stains. They are collectively my brain. Though Amen specializes in a type of brain scan that involves injecting patients with a radioactive isotope, I opted instead for a safer-sounding EEG test, which was performed earlier by a tall, blonde neuroscientist in high-waisted leggings. "Is that a pervert's brain?" I ask Amen. "Have you ever been knocked out?" he inquires, ignoring the question, or maybe answering it. "Only once." I tell him about an afternoon more than a decade before when a group of guys attacked me for no apparent reason as I was walking to my apartment in Manhattan. "Where exactly did they hit you?" "I think the blow that knocked me out was here." I touch the upper left side of my skull. "That could be important." "In what way?" "Your brain is really soft, and your skull is really hard. And inside your skull, there are a whole bunch of ridges. The incidence of head trauma in sex addicts is huge, and nobody knows that because most addicts see therapists. And the problem with therapists is they tell you all about your brain, but they never actually look at it." "So do I have brain damage?" Fuck, another item to add to the grocery list of what's wrong with me. "Your scan showed some mild evidence of injury." He studies the images again, decoding a language few understand. "You also have, and this is sort of funny, high slow wave activities. Do you know about ADD? "I know about it." "Did anybody ever suggest you had it?" "No, never." "I think a lot of your behavior is classic ADD stuff, especially the excitement seeking and the conflict. Wanting to be with new women is a biological drive to keep the species going, but it's totally destructive when you can't pair bond appropriately and then be involved in raising a family." As he speaks, I realize that's the exact problem. These two contradictory evolutionary desires for variety and for family have been tearing me apart, and on the journey to reconcile them, not only am I getting neither, but I'm discovering I'm insane. 2 months ago, I was just a jerk who cheated on his girlfriend and felt really shitty about it. I'd never seen or even wanted to see a therapist in my life. Now, all of a sudden, I have generalized anxiety syndrome, depressive disorder, socialization problems, brain damage, ADD, sex addiction, eroticized rage, developmental trauma disorder, emotional incest syndrome, Axis 5 impairment, and who knows what else. It's a miracle I can function in society at all. I'm also noticing here that when your eyes were open, the back part of your brain fired up a lot more, which is a bad thing. "Why is that?" I ask. "I don't think I can take another disorder. I might as well just get a lobotomy at this point." "Because that means you notice everybody who passes by." "Yeah, that's been somewhat of a problem." "When your visual center is turned on all the time like that, it can be painful to your partner if you're not careful." He laughs. I laugh. We relate. We are men. I look down and notice his wedding ring. "How does your girlfriend react when you're out and do that?" "She's been good about it, but I really haven't done it lately, except..." I tell him about my recent lapses. "Well, part of it is patterning," he replies. "You work so hard to figure out women that you're still like a hunter. It's so deeply ingrained, you're not going to be able to just walk out of here and stop it. The other problem is that your prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that's supposed to act as the brake, is a little weak. So when you see a really pretty girl and you go, "I'd love to have sex with her," your frontal lobe then plays it out. It's confirmed. I've got a mind like a streaming porn site. I have a future as a dirty old man to look forward to when my prefrontal cortex deteriorates even more with age. "So does my brain suggest sex addiction then?" I ask him. He flips through my EEG results and concludes, "My prefrontal cortex is weak, making it difficult to repress my instincts. My anterior cingulate gyrus, which he describes as a gear shifter that helps the brain switch between different thoughts and activities, gets stuck, making me obsessive about women I encounter. And my emotional lobes are overactive, so I can easily be provoked into acting out by something Ingrid says or does, even if I'm not conscious of the exact trigger." "Finally," he says grimly, "the brain has safety circuits that form when we experience repetitive physical and emotional caretaking from nurturing predictable, secure figures. If your mom is handicapped and had to hire a babysitter after failing to take care of you on her own, that means there's probably little or no safety circuit formation in your brain. So you can fall in love for the short term, but long-term emotional attachment may be harder to achieve and sustain." In other words, on top of everything else, half the lobes and circuits of my brain are fucked up. Do you think there's any truth to the saying that a man is as faithful as his options? I ask, hoping for a small reprieve. "I don't think that's true," he replies adamantly. "You're as faithful as you decide to be if your brain is healthy. If your brain is not healthy, then you're as faithful as your options. And we're going to make your brain healthy." He then prescribes a lengthy regimen to heal my screwed up head. Neurofeedback to retrain my brain, herbal supplements to improve my frontal lobe functioning, a healthy diet to keep my blood sugar balanced, omega-3 and vitamin D to reduce my cravings, and yes, more sex addiction therapy. He sends me away with a cardboard box loaded with his books, audio programs, and branded supplements. When I return home, I look up local sex addiction meetings to attend, order a Patrick Carnes recovery kit, research neurofeedback clinicians, and I call Charles about finding a sponsor. This is my new life.
Stage 3. Love avoidant. Further engulfment by partner leads to withdrawal from relationship and intensity seeking. Love addict. Experiences an undeniable incident or awareness that ends the fantasy.
Chapter 9. Fast forward through 10 months of meetings and step study groups, working to curb my lust with my fellow former philanderers. 10 months of group therapy, learning to be emotional and powerless with Sheila Cartwright. 10 months of one-on-one therapy, reporting my every carnal thought to an additional sex addiction therapist. 10 months of neurofeedback and supplements and everything else Daniel Amen prescribed. 10 months of filling out Patrick Carnes' workbooks and reading his daily meditations and talking to sponsors and letting go to higher powers and making inventories of my sex life. And where am I? The sun is setting, and I'm taking a short break from reading Facing Love Addiction by Pia Melody, which my sex addiction therapist recommended finishing before our next session, to answer a call from Adam. Suddenly, I hear Ingrid's steps outside, purposely loud. Each obnoxious stomp of her heels on the wood forms a word in a sentence. "I'm coming home. Stop whatever you're doing and pay attention to me." Adam and I have been talking every night, and I've come to admire him. I don't think he's even looked twice at another woman since leaving rehab. He's just been trying to get his wife to look at him. He's in the middle of telling me that his soccer team was practicing with one of the women's teams, and even though there was nothing inappropriate about it, his wife saw this, got jealous, and flipped out. She said she doesn't trust him anymore to play soccer. So what are you going to do? I ask. You know, Neil, I looked at my wife, and I understood. I thought, how could someone want to be with me after what I've done? I always think, how could I give her back what I've taken away from her by my affair? So I'm gonna stop playing soccer for a while. I want to show her that our relationship is what's most important to me. Now Ingrid's knocking, even though I gave her the house keys when she moved in. The rapping is nonstop. It's not polite like a neighbor, or even impolite like someone delivering a package. It's just annoying, like someone hitting a pipe with a hammer when you're trying to sleep. I gotta go, Adam, but I don't think you should quit doing the things you love just because she feels threatened by them. Let's talk later. I slip the phone in my pocket and walk to the door to let Ingrid in. Want to watch The Twilight Zone? She asks, bursting inside, grinning ear to ear. She places Hercules on the floor and stomps in circles around him, trying to make me laugh. Not right now. I have to read for a little. Her face drops. Following the advice and silently seduced, I've been making an effort to put my needs first in the relationship to avoid feeling enmeshed. But so far, all it seems to be doing is intensifying Ingrid's own abandonment fears, because now she thinks I'm falling out of love with her and is constantly seeking reassurance. Skitty Kits? She chirps. It's a card game a friend of ours invented. When I'm done with this chapter, okay? I find it easy to say no once, but after two or three requests, I start to feel guilty and lose my resolve. Sheila tells me that continuously complying with someone else's priorities at the expense of my own is called pathological accommodation. Okay. She hugs me. I hug her back. At each point where her body makes contact with mine, a nerve ending freezes and stiffens. The chain reaction builds all the way to my heart until finally she releases me. When Ingrid and I were at a rooftop bar last week, she was tipsy and clingy, and I was seized by an inexplicable impulse to hurl myself over the divider and into the void below. That's when I understood why some people spontaneously jump off rooftops and bridges and window ledges. They do it because it's easier than almost everything else in life. It's easier to jump than divorce your wife. Easier to jump than try to win a girlfriend back. Easier to jump than ask your boss for a raise. Easier to jump than deal with your growing pile of unpaid bills. Easier to jump than face your wife and kids after letting them down. Easier to jump than spend every day in meetings and therapy trying to be someone you're not. It's easier and quicker. It solves every problem with certainty, swiftness, and finality. I sit on the sofa and continue reading the book, hoping Ingrid will get the hint. Instead, she sits next to me, cranes her head over my shoulder, and reads the page out loud, her voice histrionic and staccato, trying to be funny. Resentment, she reads, is the anger the avoidant feels because of thinking he or she has been victimized by the partner's neediness or by the partner's demands for connection in their relationship. She tries to make eye contact, which I don't return. Do you feel like that? My sponsor advised me to always be honest and vulnerable, no matter how difficult it may be. So I tell Ingrid, I'm feeling it right now. I force a smile so the words don't seem too harsh. She touches her temple and closes her eyes for a moment, taking it in. Can I ask you a question? I don't know. Can it wait? Her face starts to fall. I can't take an argument right now, so I pathologically accommodate. Okay, what is it? Why is this relationship different from your other ones? It seems not just like a need for reassurance, but an accusation. Because I enjoy being with you. I appreciate you inside and out. And you make me laugh. She folds her arms across her chest. So I just make you laugh. Is that it? No, I love you. And I really do. Just not right now. What do you love about me? It's a feeling. I get it in my heart when I'm with you. Just not right now. She's silent. What's the problem? I feel like I'm being cross-examined, but I don't even know what I'm being charged with. She bites her lower lip and gazes down at Hercules. Then she hits me with it. So why are you working so hard to stay in this relationship? It's a good question. One I've been asking myself lately. I think back on my past girlfriends. I broke up with Kathy because she was constantly jealous. I broke up with Katie because she kept cheating on me. And I broke up with Lisa, my most serious relationship before this, because she started to remind me of my mother. But with Ingrid, I can't find anything hopelessly wrong with her, any way to use her behavior or shortcomings as an excuse to flee. Sure, she's being a pain in the ass right now, and she shuts down when she's angry, smothers me with affection, demands my attention when I want to work, can be needy due to her abandonment issues, and has some understandable insecurities because I cheated. But these are all things a guy can live with. So if I can't find anything significantly wrong with her, then it must accept the only other conclusion available. The problem is still me. And after months of working on me, I'm a bigger mess than I was when this whole thing started. When I was dating Ingrid and cheating behind her back, everything was in stasis. She was happy. I was happy enough. We were living in ignorant bliss. Those were the good old lies. But now, everything I once thought I liked about myself has been turned into a symptom of something wrong with me. I'm told over and over by addiction experts not to trust anything I say, think, or feel. They tell me I need to build self-esteem from within. Yet in order to do that, I have to accept that I'm broken, shattered, stigmatized, diseased, and traumatized. And all that does is make me want to throw myself off a rooftop so I can start all over again. And so, instead of being healed, I've become raw, edgy, irritable, and moody. The blood flowing through my veins feels like it's filled with sand and broken glass. And my sexuality is boiling over. Despite using the 3-second rule, I'm attracted to any woman under 300 pounds and some cartoon characters. I feel like the drunk who can't get any booze, then starts chugging mouthwash and rubbing alcohol. I'm ready to scrape the bottom of the barrel. And Ingrid's become so sensitive to my moods that I'm sure she's aware of this. Well, why? She asks again. Didn't I tell her 30 times already that I wanted some alone time to read? How am I supposed to take care of my needs when she won't listen to me? As I'm trying to figure out how to respond without creating a worse scene, my phone beeps. I check it quickly. It's a text from Calvin, who's just returned from Brazil and sent a picture of his baby boy. I return the phone to my pocket without answering him. Who was that? That was Calvin from my therapy group. She frowns and squints at me. It seems like you're hiding something. No, I just thought it would be rude to respond to him while we were talking. Well, it seems sneaky. I want to tell her to lay off me, to remind her that she said she trusted me, to ask to see her fucking phone. But I managed to stay, just barely, in the functional adult. It really was Calvin. You can check my phone. I've been totally good. Actually, I think I'm in the punished adolescent ego state. I don't need to do that. She strokes my face lightly, so soft it feels more irritating than soothing, like a fly buzzing around my cheek. I'm sorry, she says, looking into my eyes, hoping for something in return. But all I feel is a rising tide of revulsion. In the last 10 minutes, we've gone through a whole mini soap opera of love, suspicion, and reconciliation. I'm emotionally exhausted. I look into her eyes and try to stop the enmeshed monster inside me from taking over. But it's too late. The love I see shining there is like a bear trap, snapped shut on my soul to keep me from straying. I am a prisoner of fear. And in that moment, I realize that the self-destructive impulse I've had lately is not actually about wanting to hurt myself. It's about freedom. It's about not wanting to live under constant scrutiny, to be responsible for her feelings, to feel guilty if I happen to have a sexual thought that's not about her, to feel like my every word or expression is a red-hot brand that may scar her. Once again, my girlfriend has turned into my mother. Ingrid doesn't trust me. She doesn't give me space, and her happiness seems to depend almost entirely on my behavior. Things could be worse, I futilely try to console myself. At least Ingrid trusts me with the keys to the house. I head to the bathroom to be alone for a few moments, first setting the phone on the table so Ingrid doesn't think I'm sneaking any texts in there. I close the door and stand in front of the mirror, staring blankly at the face staring blankly back at me. There are crow's feet forming around my eyes. The creases of worry in my forehead are starting to turn into actual wrinkles, and I'm getting gray hairs in my beard. Maybe I've passed my peak. The decaying process has begun. When is this sex addiction recovery going to start working? I can't go on like this forever. Pretty soon I'm going to be too old to be a good dad who can still relate to his children and play ball with them. It's been almost a year, and I'm definitely not happy. It seems more like I'm repressing my authentic self than becoming it. When I return from the bathroom, Ingrid's sitting at the kitchen table with my phone in her hand. Her eyes are blazing, and her jaw is thrust out, but I have no idea why she looks so angry. I've done nothing wrong. Who's Belle? Except for that. I get a hollow feeling in the pit of my stomach. Passwords are useless when you have a suspicious girlfriend who likes reading over your shoulder. What are you doing looking at my phone? I snap. If only she'd have let me read in peace. Who is she? Ingrid asks again, angrier, louder, more abrasive. I try to answer, but my breath catches in my throat and burns there with shame. Guilt is about the way you breathe. Shame is about the fact that you breathe. She's just some girl I slept with a long time ago, before I ever met you, I finally managed to utter. I don't know why I stayed in touch with her. I'm so sorry, it was really dumb. I have a weak prefrontal cortex. Give me my key back, she yells. No, not that. The key around my neck, the symbol of trust. Anything but that. I can't believe you would do that, Neil. Give me my key. She grabs the necklace and pulls hard on the chain, trying to break the clasp. Okay, just let go. She's right. I don't deserve it. I don't deserve her. I'm not angry anymore, at least not at her. I'm pissed at myself. I remove the necklace and give her the key to her file cabinet back. I told Belle I was in a relationship, but she kept sending flirtatious messages, and though I didn't encourage her again, I didn't do enough to discourage her either, and I definitely fantasized about her a lot. I should have ignored her or blocked her number and had the courage to immediately apologize to Ingrid after I fucked up the first time. Perhaps relationships are like heart surgery. Even the smallest mistake can be fatal. And now I've undone almost a year of earning Ingrid's trust back. It must have been my enmeshment, or pathological accommodation, or sex addiction, or ADD, or damaged brain, or all of them working together in a symphony of self-sabotage. Ingrid takes the key, storms out of the house, gets in her car, and drives away. And now, I've gotten my wish. I'm alone. I can breathe. I can read. I can do whatever I want. And it sucks. Chapter 10. I can't go on like this, I tell Calvin as we sit at a Japanese curry restaurant a week later, discussing the situation. I've gone through a lot of emotions about this stuff too, Calvin replies. There's no end to it. It's not like, go do this work for a few months or years, then you'll be better. They want us to be in meetings and therapy for the rest of our lives. He reaches into the back pocket of his jeans and pulls out a folded piece of paper. Look at this. It's a printout of an article about a guy named Robert Weiss, who runs a treatment center in Los Angeles called the Sexual Recovery Institute. Not another place, I sigh. Read it, Calvin urges. Troy emailed it to me. Rob Weiss used to work with Patrick Carnes, but their egos clashed or something, so he broke off and started his own center. I read that the Sexual Recovery Institute was sold to Elements Behavioral Health, a big rehab chain, and they're planning to take Weiss's institute nationwide with luxury sex addiction centers around the country for, as the article puts it, wealthy sex addicts, and two-week outpatient programs for those of lesser means. Can't you see what's going on? Calvin presses. Think about it. If you add up all the people who've cheated in their relationships, that's tens of millions of customers in the U.S. alone. Now add to that the even huger number of people who watch porn, and this is the smartest business plan in the world. If they turn being male and horny into some kind of brain cancer that's covered by health insurance, they'll be billionaires. It would be one thing if the treatment worked, I gripe, but it's taken over my entire life. Like, half the time, I'm too busy going to meetings and reading books on intimacy to actually be intimate with Ingrid. After finding the texts with Belle, Ingrid spent the night sleeping on the sofa in her office. Though we talked it through for hours when she finally came home, she showed no signs of forgiving or forgetting. It's no joke, Calvin replies. There are a bunch of websites about this. Remember when Joan made me add up all the money I spent on sex? Well, if I keep doing this, I'll end up spending even more money on recovery. I hate that everything he's saying makes sense. And I'm relieved that everything he's saying makes sense. Most people who go to rehab relapse, he continues. So what's the point? And Sheila doesn't want me to bring Mariana and Flavio, his Brazilian and their baby, over here because it's not good for my recovery. But that's my son, and I have to do what's in my heart. That can't be wrong, right? I don't know what's right anymore, man, I tell him. I don't know. But despite my frustration, I have to say, the enmeshment stuff really fits me like a glove. That part may be true, he says, but remember, this is the same profession that said homosexuality was a disease and gave gay people electroshock treatment and lobotomies. And you know what? Back then, therapists probably blamed it on smothering mothers also. Maybe we're just different sexually, but the world hasn't accepted it yet. He's making a good argument, too dangerous to consider. When I grew up, there were two women in my life, my mother and a live-in babysitter. So maybe it's natural for me to want multiple female caregivers. And who's to say that this broad definition of sex addiction we've been learning isn't just modern-day quackery, with Carnes as the Kevorkian of the male libido? Doctors used to claim that there was a disease called drapetomania, a disorder in which slaves were seized by the irrational and pathological desire to be freed from their masters. They're all just words made up by people with degrees to enforce social norms. You may be right. I respond noncommittally. It could just be the way we're wired. Perhaps sex addiction is the new ADD or Asperger's syndrome. It's very real for some people, but it's also massively overdiagnosed, and anyone who doesn't fit a certain unrealistic standard of behavior is labeled with it. Pretty soon, just like there are 6-year-old kids taking Ritalin and Adderall, some poor child who strips a Barbie doll naked will be getting sex addiction treatment. We got sucked into a weird fringe pseudoscience. Calvin stabs a fork into his chicken cutlet. Most of this stuff has never been proven. Talk to scientists. Talk to doctors. Talk to other therapists. Talk to any single person except for Patrick Carnes and his minions. Even that brain doctor you went to isn't taken seriously by most of the medical community. Rick told me to trust the experts, but maybe I just chose the wrong ones. Sex addiction isn't even in the DSM, Calvin goes on, his ovoid face heated red. It was considered and completely rejected. We've been chasing a ghost. Chapter 11. One of the benefits of writing for Rolling Stone is that I can get just about anyone on the phone. So after talking to Calvin, I go on a rampage for knowledge, contacting as many of the world's most credible relationship experts as I can to get their point of view on the issues we discussed. I start with the anthropologist, Dr. Helen Fisher. For more than 2 decades, she's been studying love, sex, and marriage across cultures, species, and time, becoming, in the process, arguably the most cited living researcher on the science of relationships. Her conclusion? We are an adulterous animal. In her book, Anatomy of Love, she explains the origins of this behavior thusly. During our long evolutionary history, most males pursued trysts to spread their genes, while females evolved 2 alternative strategies to acquire resources. Some women elected to be relatively faithful to a single man in order to reap a lot of benefits from him. Others engaged in clandestine sex with many men to acquire resources from each. This scenario roughly coincides with the common beliefs: man, the natural playboy; woman, the Madonna or the whore. Based on her current research, however, Fisher feels a little differently about that passage in the book. I think I would amend that if I could write it now, she tells me. Among men and women under the age of 40 today, women are just as adulterous as men. Fisher explains that our ancestors unfaithfully pair-bonded just long enough to conceive and raise a child until it developed some degree of autonomy. Then they moved on to raise a child with and cheat on someone else. She describes this as a dual reproductive strategy: serial monogamy plus clandestine adultery. So, I think as she explains all this, if my goal is to be in a relationship that's true to my authentic self, then cheating on Ingrid was the way to do it. Now all I need to do is marry her, father a couple of children, start cheating again, be cheated on, and divorce. This is evidently love among Homo sapiens. Call it phonogamy. However, even if Fisher's theory is true, there's a problem with this lifestyle in the modern world. As the Red Demons and I unfortunately discovered, it causes a lot of pain, destroys any hope of intimacy, and traumatizes everyone in the family. In addition to the ethical issues, with keystroke capturing software, phone bills, credit card statements, and social networking profiles with tagged photos all easily accessible, it's almost impossible for a cheater not to leave a technological slime trail for a determined partner to discover. So I ask Fisher how to best overcome our evolutionary past and have a successful, lasting relationship today. She responds by explaining that we've developed three different primary brain systems for mating. One for sex, another for romantic love, and a third for deep attachment. And after the initial intensity of a new relationship, our romance and sex drives often swing toward other people, while our attachment drive remains connected to our primary partner. However, before I can draw any conclusions, Fisher says that this natural ebbing of romance and sexuality can be prevented. The solution, she elaborates, is for couples to do novel and exciting things together, to release dopamine and get the romance rush. Make love regularly, to release oxytocin and sexually bond. Cut themselves off from cheating opportunities, and, in general, make sure their partners are continually thrilling enough to keep all three drives humming. Wow, that's a lot to ask of two people, I tell her. Yes, she retorts. And even then, you still may want to sleep with other people on the side. So if you're gonna cheat, for God's sake, don't get caught. This is it then. Helen Fisher, the world's leading expert on mating, has given me permission to cheat. I'm shocked that this is the prevailing scientific consensus on relationships. I've been working so hard to accept the premise that my desire for other women is a lifelong disease and only faith in a higher power can put it in remission. But perhaps it's not enmeshment or trauma or sex addiction that makes the notion of lifelong monogamy so unappealing. It's just, as I initially told Rick, part of our nature. Even Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, the fathers of modern psychotherapy, appear to have had affairs, the former with his wife's sister, the latter with a patient. The prerequisite for a good marriage, Jung wrote in a letter to Freud, it seems to me, is the license to be unfaithful. And Bill W., the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, was so notorious for cheating on his wife with attractive women who attended sobriety meetings, that his colleagues later started calling this type of lechery the 13th step. By Carnes' standards, they'd be addicts. By Fisher's, they'd be successful Homo sapiens. By society's, they'd be creeps. It's all very confusing. Over the next few days, I dive deeper into the science of mating, but I'm unable to find a single credible item in the entire canon of evolutionary and anthropological literature that supports the contention that human beings are supposed to pick one partner and then remain faithfully and exclusively with that person for life. On top of everything, I'd been feeling so guilty for avoiding intimacy with Ingrid by fantasizing. But it turns out a study on sexual fantasies conducted by researchers at the University of Vermont concluded that 98% of men and 80% of women report having sexual fantasies about people other than their partners. So of course it's a struggle to focus 100% of my sexual attention and desire on Ingrid. I'm fucking normal. There's something liberating about that thought, because I'm tired of beating myself up every day. Even when I finally managed to find a group of researchers studying the benefits of monogamy to society, historically, it's increased the number of available women and reduced the number of single men, leading to less competition for partners and reduced crime and violence. They admit that not only does their definition of monogamy not preclude cheating, but they don't believe that monogamy is natural either. If it were all genetic, if humans just by nature mated for life, and there were a very tight pair bond, Professor Peter J. Richardson explains, then we wouldn't need all these marriage customs. As for marriage itself, historian Stephanie Kuntz, the author of Marriage, A History, tells me that the tradition was never even supposed to be about intimacy. For the majority of its history, marriage was an economic and political institution, mostly about merging resources, forming alliances, or creating a bloodline for inheritance, she explains. Not until the late 18th century did people marry for love, and it took until the late 20th century for marriage to start becoming an intimate partnership rather than a patriarchal institution. Today, Kuntz believes that the tradition is changing yet again. People want to be monogamous or promiscuous, she says. They want kids or they don't want kids. They want this or they want that. For centuries, they had to hide those preferences and take everything as a package deal. Now you don't have to. It's literally pick and choose. Cut and paste the kind of life you want. Family life and love relationships are essentially becoming a build-your-own model. Perhaps Calvin was right, I think, as I leave Kuntz's house that evening. Maybe we have been brainwashed. Either that, or we're living in a 21st century culture that's moving quickly, but stuck in 20th century institutions that change too slowly. Then again, no matter what your point of view may be, you can always find someone with a PhD to support it. Chapter 12. And so I find myself, nearly a year after returning from rehab, caught between one school of thought telling me I have an incurable psychosexual disease that I need to treat daily, and another making a very convincing argument that over 200,000 years of human culture and evolution support my behavior as perfectly natural. In the meantime, my relationship with Ingrid has become a roller coaster. One minute we're laughing together and staring lovingly into each other's eyes. The next we're either arguing or not speaking. Most nights I end up sleeping on the couch. Meanwhile, Hercules has somehow gone from sleeping on the floor next to the bed to sleeping on the comforter at the bottom of the bed to sleeping on a pillow at the head of the bed to spooning with Ingrid. One afternoon, for a Rolling Stone article I'm writing, the British singer Ellie Goulding meets me in Malibu to play some music she's been working on. We paddleboard in the ocean and discuss her art and her life. When Ingrid comes home from work with Hercules in tow, I fill her in on the day. We talked a lot about abandonment because her dad walked out on her and her mom, I recap. One day she was feeling really sad, so she texted him and asked, "Do you still love me?" But her father's new wife texted back and said to leave him alone and stop bothering him. It's so cruel. We were both practically crying. Ingrid stiffens and says dryly, "Oh, so you both cried together?" It's a tone of voice I've heard before, like a clap of thunder on a sunny day, bringing with it a storm. She walks angrily out of the room, then returns seconds later, bombarding me with questions. "Why did you exchange numbers with her? What made you invite her here? And why did she come while I was at work?" Ingrid's certain I had ulterior motives, which in this rare case I didn't. She listens testily as I explain this. Then she utters the four words that are the kiss of death to any relationship. "Show me your phone." While Ingrid analyzes every word of my exchanges with Goulding, I look at Hercules, who's sleeping on his back on the bed. His shriveled little organ hangs there, robbed of its function and purpose, so he can be a servant whose sole job is giving affection and unconditional acceptance to his mistress. It seems wrong to rob any living thing of the joy of sex. When Ingrid finishes going through my phone, we spend half an hour bickering about Goulding. This is the first time she's accused me of something I haven't actually done and refused to believe the truth. And it feels horrible. Not only is this a direct consequence of all the times I have broken trust, but it can't be easy dating someone who has to work so hard not to cheat on her. No woman wants a sex addict as a partner, except maybe a love addict. Eventually, Ingrid collapses on the bed next to Hercules and lapses into sullen, tearful silence. For the first year of our relationship, she was always smiling, laughing, and busy with creative projects. One of the reasons I fell in love with her was that she cast a ray of sunshine that penetrated even the darkest corners of my thoughts. But now her light and creativity seem to have extinguished completely. She doesn't even speak to her friends anymore because they don't approve of her dating me. As I look at the tear-wrecked mascara around Ingrid's eyes, the deep frown on her face, and the tragic fetal ball she forms around Hercules, my mother's warning echoes in my head. Never grow up to make anyone as miserable as your father makes me.
Stage 4. Love avoidant. Leaves relationship and repeats cycle with new partner. Love addict. Returns to fantasy about partner or repeats cycle with new partner.
Chapter 13. When she steps into the car, wearing a red dress with her ever-present black boots, I'm relieved to see her. Of all the professionals I've met, she's the only one who truly seems to see the tangled, invisible strings that guide human behavior. And the first words out of Lorraine's mouth not only shock me, but they're exactly what I need to hear right now. "We had a discussion when you left rehab," she says. "And we don't think you're a sex addict." "Really? You have a sexual compulsivity, and it's one of many symptoms of your upbringing." "Thank you." I'm not sure what the exact difference is between an addiction and a compulsion, and I don't care. Her words are the final bolt, sliding open and setting me free from all the shame, repression, and struggle of the last year. It's the best compliment anyone's given me since I started this whole process. After my argument with Ingrid, I emailed Lorraine, who probably knows me on a deeper level than anyone, to ask whether breaking up would be a healthy decision for Ingrid and me, or a mistake we'll regret for the rest of our lives. She replied that she was coming to town soon to run a workshop in Orange County, and we could discuss it in person then. So I invited her to dinner with Rick and me. When we enter the Italian restaurant Giorgio Baldi, we spot Rick sitting alone in a white t-shirt. I've rarely seen him wear anything else. He smiles and nods his head in gentle greeting as I introduce him to Lorraine. After we order, I let Rick know that I'm ready to throw in the towel on the whole "accept everything a sex addiction expert says" idea. "It's been a year and I'm still not happy," I tell him. "I followed everything to the letter, and I've learned a lot. But not only is my relationship hanging by a thread right now, what hasn't budged is my desire to be with other people and my belief that I should." I study Rick's face for a reaction. He takes it in and closes his eyes lightly, as if arriving at a thought, or more accurately, letting a thought arrive to him. But before he can respond, Lorraine asks me, "Is that outside your value system?" "No." "Then I don't see what's wrong with it. After my husband died, I decided I didn't want to live with anyone again. I live alone, and I'm happy, and I wouldn't want anyone in that space, and that's what's right for me. What's great about today is that there are many different options, and you can choose any one that's true to you." I'm surprised to find her so open-minded. It sounds like she's changed her beliefs since rehab, so I ask her about it. "Everything I told you during your chair work was true," she says. "However, Joan is the program director, and she has very strict guidelines about condoning any sexual behavior outside of a committed, monogamous relationship. So I can't always say everything that I think there." "So you actually do believe it's possible to have intimacy outside of monogamy?" I press, just to make sure I'm understanding her correctly. "There are some couples who have a lifelong relationship and children, and they agree to have an open marriage," she responds. "As long as both people are truthful and intimate and operating with integrity, I'm not going to judge them." I look at the powder-dabbed wrinkles on her face, the folds of skin threatening to pull down her neck, and the earned intelligence in her eyes. And I think, thank you for understanding. I'm surprised by how much her approval means to me. Maybe it's because my permission to be a sexual being was taken away from me in rehab. It was my punishment for abusing that right in my relationship, for harming someone innocent with it. And now, after a year of probation, I'm finally being granted provisional custody of it again. I feel like I'm ready to explore other relationship styles, but I'm a little scared, I tell Lorraine. I've been waking up every morning this week full of anxiety about losing Ingrid. I'm worried I won't be able to find this quality of love again, and I'm ruining what may be my only chance for a happy future and family. I'm so bad at commitment, I can't even commit to being uncommitted. Ambivalence. That's my higher power. All hail ambivalence, destroyer of relationships. Meanwhile, Rick sits in silence, listening to the conversation, nodding and collecting thoughts. Have you asked Ingrid if she's open to another type of relationship? Lorraine suggests as the food arrives. That would be the perfect solution, I tell her. I just don't think she'd be into it, though. You may be surprised, she says. Just as we have a family of origin that we're stuck with, we can create a family of choice that we freely select. And in some ways, it feels like I'm sitting with a functional mother and father I've chosen. This is when Rick finally opens his mouth to speak. What I wish for you, he begins, measuring each word to make sure it lands as powerfully as possible, is that you commit all the way to living this adventurous lifestyle you want, without any other option, because you need to get to the place where you have all the women you desire and find out it doesn't solve your loneliness or your need for connection or your pain. I'm shocked by the severity of his words. I thought we had an agreement that I would try each path without judgment. That wasn't the way you put it when we first discussed it, I tell Rick. Well, I had a little more hope for you then. But this seems to be what you wanted all along. Lorraine watches him speak. I feel a mounting sense of anxiety that she's going to agree with him. If you're indeed going to follow through with your decision, she eventually says, arbitrating, I'm going to ask you to solve a mystery. What's the mystery? The mystery is whether the path you're embarking on is authentic or you're operating out of a wound. How will I know the difference? Wounds bring drama and trauma. They don't bring comfort. She pauses to make sure I understand, then elaborates. We all have 6 core needs. Emotional, social, intellectual, physical, sexual, and spiritual. And if they're being attended to and enhanced, then you're doing the right thing. If this choice is coming from a healthy place, Rick adds, then you'll find that it leads to lasting happiness. It seems less like he's backing down, and more like he's decided to let me learn for myself where this path will lead. I hope it does, I tell them. Maybe I'll be able to find someone who shares my beliefs and values. As the words leave my lips, I worry that I'll end up with the fate I deserve. A woman who's just like me. Remember, Lorraine urges, as if reading my thoughts, anything that doesn't bring you alive is too small for you. And whatever you do, Rick adds ominously, I hope you do it cleanly and honestly, with no baggage. Chapter 14. This is the best relationship I've ever had, I tell her. I've never loved anyone so much. We are lying in our spare bedroom, which Ingrid decorated and named the spaceship room. There are 4 mattresses pushed together on the floor and black sheets covering the ceiling and windows. A projector plays videos of galaxies on the wall, another beams constellations onto the ceiling, and a light-up toy moon hangs over our heads. The room itself is a testament to Ingrid's playful creativity, and another reason I admire her. Yet nonetheless, I'm about to break her heart. And mine. And that's the problem, I continue. The problem? I start to stutter. It's hard for me to spit out the words that come next. Tears well in her eyes. She knows what's coming. "I don't want to lose you," she says, yet she knows she will. We sit in silence for a moment. Then she continues. "I feel like all our problems lately have been my fault because I haven't felt safe, and that's made me distant and suspicious. I want to let her believe that, but it's not the truth." "No, it's me," I tell her. "I feel horrible. I feel selfish. I feel guilty. I feel defective. I don't know, but maybe we can try, as an experiment, a less traditional type of relationship, just for a little while, to get things out of my system." Who am I kidding? These things will never leave my system. I've tried. "To get what out of your system?" she asks. I take a deep breath. I start to shake. I'm nervous to say what comes next. "I don't think I'll ever be able to earn back your trust." Long pause. "Because I don't think it will ever feel right for me not to be with anyone else for the rest of my life." There, I said it. I look at her prismatic eyes, her high cheekbones, the delicate double V of her neck and shoulder blades, and that intangible quality of her soul that is more beautiful and enduring than all of it. I don't want her to have a body like that woman on the plane, or to leave me alone when she comes home from work, or to stop reading over my shoulder. I'm embarrassed that I ever had those thoughts. And I wonder, why is she not enough? Why can't I just be happy with her? And my eyes start to water. She doesn't get angry. She doesn't break down crying. She looks me in the eyes and says,